Let's look at Part 1, Part 61, and Part 91. Part 1 contains definitions and abbreviations. For example, the term night, the time between the end of evening civil twilight and the beginning of morning civil twilight as published in the American Air Almanac, converted to local time. Well, that's what night means, and is used for logging nighttime. Part 61, certification, pilots, flight instructors, and ground instructors, prescribes the requirements for issuing certificates to pilots and flight instructors. It also prescribes the requirement for the issuance of ratings. Part 91 is entitled General Operating and Flight Rules, and Part 91 describes rules governing the operation of aircraft within the United States. The National Transportation Safety Board has established rules and requirements also, and their rules and requirements are for notification and reporting of aircraft accidents and incidents. These are contained in NTSB Part 830. Let's talk about airspace. The two categories of airspace are regulatory and non-regulatory. Within these two categories, there are four types of airspace: controlled, uncontrolled, special use, and other airspace areas. What you've got to know about airspace is you have to know the basic weather minimums for operating in the different classes of airspace. You also need to know the operational and equipment requirements. Let's talk about controlled airspace. Controlled airspace is a generic term that covers the different classifications of airspace. Controlled airspace consists of Class Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta, and Echo airspace. Class Alpha airspace is, generally speaking, the airspace that extends from 18,000 feet MSL up to and including flight level 600. It includes all airspace overlying the waters within 12 nautical miles of the coast of the 48 contiguous United States and Alaska. Unless otherwise authorized, all operations in Class Alpha airspace will be conducted under instrument flight rules. Class Alpha airspace is not depicted on the sectional aeronautical charts. Class Bravo airspace is generally the airspace from the surface to 10,000 feet MSL surrounding the nation's busiest airports. The dimensions and the configuration of Class Bravo airspace is individually tailored to the needs of the particular area, and it consists of a surface area and two or more layers. Some Class Bravo airspace resembles an upside-down wedding cake. At least a private pilot certificate is required to operate in Class Bravo airspace. However, student and recreational pilots seeking private pilot certification are allowed to operate in Class Bravo airspace and land at other than the specified primary airports within Bravo airspace if they have received training and had their logbooks endorsed by a certified flight instructor. Each of the Class Bravo airspace sectors are outlined in blue on the sectional aeronautical chart, and there's a label with its delimiting altitudes. On the terminal chart, each Class Bravo airspace sector is outlined in blue and labeled with its delimiting arcs, its radials and altitudes, and visual checkpoints. A clearance from air traffic control is required prior to operating in Class Bravo airspace. When you operate in Class Bravo airspace, you've got to have two-way radio communications and a Mode C transponder. Class Charlie airspace generally extends from the surface to 4,000 feet above the airport elevation. Class Charlie airspace surrounds those airports that have an operating control tower and that are served by a radar service or an approach control. Charlie airspace is charted in MSL and generally has a 5 nautical mile radius surface area that extends from the surface to 4,000 feet above the airport. And then it also has a 10 nautical mile radius that extends from 1,200 feet to 4,000 feet above the airport elevation. There's also an outer area of 20 nautical miles that extends from the surface to 4,000 feet. If you depart a satellite airport within Class Charlie airspace, you need to establish two-way radio communications with air traffic control as soon as practicable after takeoff. On aeronautical charts, Class Charlie airspace is depicted by solid magenta lines. Class Delta airspace generally extends from the surface to 2,500 feet above the airport elevation, and it surrounds those airports that have an operating control tower. The Class Delta airspace may include one or more airports, and it's usually 4 nautical miles in radius. The actual size and shape is depicted by a blue dashed line with numbers showing the top. When the cloud ceiling within Class D airspace is less than 1,000 feet and/or the visibility is less than 3 statute miles, if you want to take off or land, you have to hold an instrument rating and have filed an instrument flight plan. And your aircraft must be equipped for instrument flight. At some locations, if you do not hold an instrument rating, you may be authorized to take off and land when the weather is less than that required for visual flight rules, and that's called special VFR. Where special VFR is prohibited, the words "no SVFR" will be printed above the airport information on the chart. Class Echo airspace is generally controlled airspace that is not designated as Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, or Delta. Class Echo airspace has no defined vertical limit, but rather it extends upward from the surface to a designated altitude where the overlying or adjacent controlled airspace begins. On the sectional chart, where Class Echo airspace starts at 700 feet AGL, it's identified by magenta shading. Where Class E airspace begins at 1,200 feet AGL, the sectional chart shading is blue. Class E airspace may also start at other altitudes. Class E airspace also begins at the surface when it is found in conjunction with airports that have an instrument approach but no control tower. Of course, if it had a control tower, that would be Class Delta airspace. Class E airspace is also the airspace found on Victor Airways. An airway is a corridor of controlled airspace extending upward from 1,200 feet above the surface, or as a designated, some areas it's higher than 1,200 feet, up to and including 17,999 feet MSL, and it's 4 nautical miles on either side of the center line. The airway center line is shown in blue. You could say, generally speaking, that most of the controlled airspace is Class E airspace, and the question is, where does it start? Well, it begins either at the surface, or it begins at 700 feet, or it begins at 1,200 feet. If it begins at the surface, it's co-located with an airport that has a control tower, or a larger airport. If it begins at 700 feet, it's identified by magenta tint on the sectional chart, and if it starts at 1,200 feet, it's identified by a blue tint. The blue tint on the sectional chart identifies Class E airspace if it's next to Class G airspace. Class E airspace includes all the airspace from 14,500 feet up to the base of Class A airspace. Uncontrolled airspace is Class Gulf airspace. Class G, or Class Gulf airspace, is the portion of airspace that has not been designated as Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta, or Echo. Class G airspace extends from the surface to the base of the overlying Class Echo airspace. Air traffic control has no authority or responsibility for control of air traffic in Class G airspace. In some areas of the western U.S. and Alaska, Class Gulf airspace may extend from the surface all the way to 14,500 MSL. An exception to this occurs when 14,500 MSL is lower than 1,500 feet AGL. So there's controlled airspace, Class Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta, Echo, uncontrolled airspace, Class Gulf, and then there's also special use airspace and other airspace areas. Special use airspace exists where activities must be confined because of their nature. Special use airspace consists of prohibited areas, restricted areas, warning areas, military operation areas, alert areas, controlled firing areas, and national security areas. That's special use airspace. Then there's other airspace areas, such as prohibited areas, restricted areas, warning areas, military operation areas, and alert areas. Special use airspace exists where the activities must be confined because of their nature. In special use areas, limitations may be placed on aircraft that are not part of the activities. Special use airspace consists of prohibited areas, restricted areas, warning areas, military operation areas, alert areas, controlled firing areas, and national security areas. Prohibited areas are blocks of airspace in which flight of aircraft is prohibited. Prohibited areas are established for security or other reasons associated with the national welfare. Prohibited areas are published in the Federal Register and are depicted on aeronautical charts. Restricted areas are areas where there's an unusual, often invisible, hazard to aircraft, such as artillery firing, aerial gunnery, or guided missiles. Aircraft may not enter a restricted area unless permission has been obtained by the controlling agency. Restricted areas are depicted on aeronautical charts and are published in the Federal Register. Warning areas contain the same hazardous activities found in restricted areas, but warning areas are located in international airspace. Warning areas, prohibited areas, and restricted areas are shown in Legend 1, and they are depicted on aeronautical charts. Warning areas are established beyond the 3-mile limit. Military operation areas, or MOAs, consist of airspace of defined vertical and lateral limits established for certain military training activity. There's no restriction against operating VFR in these areas. However, you should be alert since training activities may include acrobatic and abrupt maneuvers. Military operations areas are depicted on aeronautical charts. When you're operating within an MOA, you should exercise extreme caution. Any flight service station within 100 miles of the area will provide you with information and hours of operation. Prior to entering an active military operations area, you should contact the controlling agency for traffic advisories. Alert areas are depicted on aeronautical charts and are to advise pilots that a high volume of pilot training or unusual aerial activity is taking place. Pilots of participating aircraft, as well as pilots transiting the area, are equally responsible for collision avoidance. A controlled firing area contains activities for which, if not conducted in a controlled environment, could be hazardous. The difference between controlled firing areas and other special use airspace is that the activities must be suspended when a spotter aircraft, radar, or ground lookout position indicates an aircraft might be approaching the area. National security areas consist of airspace of defined vertical and lateral dimensions established at locations where there's a requirement for increased security and safety of ground facilities. Pilots are requested to voluntarily avoid flying through these depicted areas. When necessary, flight may be temporarily prohibited. Other airspace areas is a generic term referring to the majority of the remaining airspace. It includes airport advisory areas, military training routes, temporary flight restrictions, parachute jump areas, and published VFR routes. An airport advisory area is an area within 10 statute miles of an airport where a control tower is not in operation, but where a flight service station is located. The flight service station provides advisory service to arriving and departing aircraft. It is not mandatory for pilots to use the advisory service, but you are recommended to do so. Military training routes, or MTRs, are used by the military for conducting low-altitude, high-speed training. Generally, military training routes are established below 10,000 feet for operations in speed of excess of 250 knots. Military training routes, or MTRs, allow the military to conduct low-altitude, high-speed training. The routes above 1,500 AGL are developed to be flown primarily under instrument flight rules, and the routes 1,500 feet or less are designed for VFR flight. The routes are identified on sectional charts by the designation instrument route or visual route. IR and VR routes are identified by four-digit numbers, for example, VR1122 or IR5005. The segments of the routes below 1500 are identified by three-digit numbers, such as IR134 or VR151. Temporary flight restrictions, or TFRs, are established when required, and the purpose of the TFR is to protect persons or property in the air or on the surface. The intent is to provide a safe environment for relief or rescue aircraft or firefighting aircraft. This helps eliminate congestion which might occur in airspace over special events, or to protect the airspace in the vicinity of presidential flights, etc. The flight service stations coordinate temporary flight restrictions, and when necessary, a notice to airmen is issued. Parachute jump areas are published in the airport facility directory. The sites that are frequently used for parachute jump areas are depicted on the sectional charts. Published VFR routes are for transitioning around, under, or through some of the complex airspace. Such terms as VFR flyway, VFR corridor, Class B airspace, VFR transition route, and terminal area VFR route have all applied to such routes. These routes are generally found on VFR terminal area planning charts. The other areas which are depicted on sectional charts are national wildlife refuge areas, wilderness and primitive areas, national monuments, and national parks. You are requested to remain at least 2,000 feet above the surface when operating in such areas. Now let's talk about acrobatic flight and alcohol and drugs. There are six places where acrobatic flight is prohibited. Acrobatic flight, by definition, is an intentional maneuver involving an abrupt change in the aircraft's altitude, an abnormal attitude, or abnormal acceleration not necessary for normal flight. The six places where acrobatic flight is prohibited is when the flight visibility is less than 3 statute miles, below an altitude of 1,500 feet above the surface, over any congested area of a city, town, or settlement, within 4 nautical miles of the centerline of a federal airway, over an open-air assembly of people, and within the lateral boundaries of Class Bravo, Charlie, Delta, or Echo airspace designated for an airport. You may not act as a crew member on an aircraft within 8 hours after the consumption of any alcoholic beverage. You may not act as a crew member on an aircraft while under the influence of alcohol, and that's defined as a 0.04% by weight or more alcohol in the blood. And you may not act as a crew member on an aircraft while using any drug that affects your faculties in any way contrary to safety. Regulation regarding alcohol and drug reads, except in an emergency, no pilot of an aircraft may allow a person who appears to be intoxicated or under the influence of drugs, except a medical patient under proper care, to be carried in that aircraft. A conviction for the violation of any law related to alcohol or drugs is a grounds for denial or suspension or revocation of any certificate or rating. If you have an alcohol or drug-related motor vehicle action, you shall provide a written report of each alcohol or drug-related motor vehicle action to the FAA Civil Aviation Security Division no later than 60 days after the motor vehicle action. Now let's talk about airworthiness. Each aircraft is issued with an airworthiness certificate, which remains valid as long as the aircraft is maintained and operated in accordance with regulations. During flight, the following certificates must be on board: the airworthiness certificate, the aircraft registration, and the operating limitations. The operating limitations are found in the form of placards, or they're printed in the aircraft flight manual, or any combination thereof. Who is responsible for maintaining the aircraft in an airworthy condition? including the compliance with airworthiness directives, the owner or operator. The pilot in command is responsible for determining that the aircraft is in airworthy condition prior to flight. Now, you can do that, of course, by doing a pre-flight inspection and by reviewing the maintenance records. Certain preventative maintenance is allowed to be performed by the pilot. Preventative maintenance is limited to such tasks as replacing defective safety wire, servicing landing gear wheel bearings, or replacing safety belts. After preventative maintenance has been performed on an aircraft, the signature, certificate type, and certificate number of the person approving the aircraft for return to service and a description of the work must be entered in the aircraft maintenance records. You're not authorized as a pilot to return the aircraft to service. That has to be done by a certified mechanic. You can't operate an aircraft within the preceding 12 calendar months unless an annual inspection has been performed and the airplane has been returned to service. This is indicated by the appropriate entry in the maintenance logs. To determine when the expiration date of the last annual inspection is, you look at the aircraft maintenance records, and a calendar month means you have until the end of the month to comply. So, if the aircraft's last annual inspection was performed on, say, July 12, 2003, the next annual inspection will be due no later than midnight, July 31, 2004. If an aircraft is used to carry passengers for hire or used in flight instruction, it must have, in addition to the annual inspection, a 100-hour inspection. An annual inspection may be substituted for the 100-hour inspection, but the 100-hour inspection may not be substituted for the annual inspection. The 100-hour limitation may be exceeded by not more than 10 hours if necessary to reach a place where the inspection can be done. The excess time, though, is included in computing the next 100-hour time in service. So, for example, if a 100-hour inspection was due at 300 hours, but the inspection was actually done at 302 hours, the next 100-hour inspection will be due 100 hours after the previous inspection was due, not after the time the inspection was actually completed. If the aircraft has been rebuilt or altered in any manner that may have appreciably changed its flight characteristics or operation in flight, no passengers may be carried until it has been flight tested by an appropriately rated pilot with at least a private pilot certificate and approved for return to service. The transponder has to be inspected within the preceding 24 calendar months. The batteries in the emergency locator transmitter must be replaced or recharged after one half of the battery's useful life or when the ELT has been in use for more than one cumulative hour. Airworthiness directives, or ADs, prescribe regulatory actions, such as inspections or modifications, which affect aircraft, and the airworthiness directive is mandatory. The compliance with the airworthiness directive must be entered in the appropriate aircraft maintenance records. The owner or operator is responsible for ensuring that ADs are complied with. Pilots may operate an aircraft not in compliance with an AD if the AD allows operation. Advisory circulars are issued by the FAA, and their purpose is to inform the aviation community of non-regulatory material of interest. They're issued in a number system corresponding to the subject areas. Advisory circulars may be obtained from the Government Printing Office bookstore. Some are free, others are at cost. There are a couple questions on the written test regarding the number sequence for advisory circulars. An advisory circular containing subject matter related to airmen is issued under subject number 60. An FAA advisory circular related to air traffic control and general operations is issued under subject number 90. And here's the tough one. FAA advisory circulars containing subject matter specifically related to airspace are issued under subject number 70. When acting as pilot in command, you have to have your pilot and medical certificate in your physical possession or readily accessible in the aircraft. If you're a glider or a balloon pilot, you don't need a medical certificate. If you are a recreational pilot acting as PIC, you must have a current logbook endorsement in your possession within flights 50 nautical miles from the departure airport. You have to present your pilot license and medical certificate for inspection upon request of any FAA, NTSB, federal, state, or local law enforcement officer request. All pilot certificates except student pilot certificates are valid indefinitely unless surrendered, superseded, or revoked. In other words, pilot certificates are issued without a specific expiration date. They're valid as long as your medical certificate is valid. If you have a student pilot license or student pilot certificate, your privileges are limited to solo flights or flights with an instructor. A private pilot has unlimited solo privileges. A private pilot can carry passengers or cargo as long as the flying is for the pilot's pleasure or personal business and is not done for compensation or hire. If you're a private pilot, you can fly in conjunction with your job, provided that flying is incidental to your employment. As a private pilot, you may not pay less than the pro rata share of the operating expenses of a flight with your passengers, provided the expenses only involve fuel, oil, airport expenditures, or rental fees. The only time passengers may pay for the entire flight is if a donation is made by the passengers to a charitable organization which is sponsoring the flight. Commercial pilots may fly for compensation or hire. And airline transport pilots may act as pilot in command of airline and scheduled commuter operations. I mentioned that a pilot certificate is issued without an expiration date. It's valid so long as your medical certificate is valid. So when do medical certificates expire? For student pilots, recreational or private pilot operations, other than glider and balloon, remember you don't need a medical for glider or balloon, but if you're a student pilot, recreational, or private pilot, you require a third-class medical certificate. A third-class medical certificate expires at the end of the 36th month after the month of issue if you haven't reached your 40th birthday yet, or if you've reached your 40th birthday on or after the date of the examination. The third-class medical certificate expires at the end of the 24th month after the month of issue. If you hold a second-class medical certificate, you may exercise commercial pilot privileges during the first 12 calendar months, but the certificate is valid only for private pilot privileges during the following 24 or 12 calendar months, depending on your age. If you hold a first-class medical certificate, you may exercise the privileges of ATP during the first 6 calendar months, and then you can exercise commercial privileges during the following 6 calendar months, and private pilot privileges during the following 12 or 24 calendar months, depending on your age. When a pilot certificate is issued, it has printed on the back of it the category, class, and type of aircraft in which the certificate holder is qualified. The term category is a broad classification of aircraft such as airplane, rotorcraft, glider, lighter than air. Category separates aircraft by really distinctive operating characteristics. Rotorcraft are distinctly different from airplanes than from gliders or lighter than air. The term class means a classification within a category having similar operating characteristics such as single engine, multi-engine, land, water, helicopter, and balloon. The term type means a specific make and model of an aircraft, such as a Lear 55 or a Boeing 737. You've got to hold a type rating if you're pilot in command of a large aircraft. Large means more than 12,500 pounds, and you have to have a type rating for all turbojet-powered aircraft, regardless of weight. If you want to fly IFR, an instrument rating is required. The recency of experience rule says that you cannot act as pilot in command unless within the preceding 24 calendar months you have accomplished a flight review. A flight review is given in an aircraft for which you're rated by an appropriately rated instructor or other person designated by the FAA. A logbook entry will document the satisfactory completion of this requirement. If you take a practical test for a new certificate or a new rating, that practical test or proficiency check counts for the flight review. You can't act as PIC carrying passengers unless within the preceding 90 days you've made 3 takeoffs and 3 landings as the sole manipulator of the controls in the same category, class, and if a type rating is required, in the same type. Touch-and-go landings are okay unless you plan on carrying passengers in a tailwheel airplane, in which case the landings must be made to a full stop, and the landings have to be made in a tailwheel airplane. If you plan on carrying passengers during the period from 1 hour after sunset to 1 hour before sunrise, then within the past 90 days, you'll have to have made at least 3 takeoffs and 3 landings during that period, and the landings for night must be made to a full stop and in the same category and class of aircraft to be used. So if you're current at night in multi-engine airplanes, but not in single-engine airplanes, you need to make those 3 landings to a full stop in the single-engine airplane. You're not allowed to act as pilot in command of an aircraft having more than 200 horsepower unless you've received instruction and a logbook endorsement. More than 200 horsepower is referred to as a high-performance airplane. You may not act as pilot in command of an aircraft towing a glider unless you've had 100 hours of pilot time in the aircraft category class or 200 hours total pilot time. Within the preceding 12 months, you need to have made at least 3 actual or simulated glider tows while accompanied by a qualified pilot, or made 3 flights as PIC of a towed glider. If you change your address, you've got 30 days to notify the FAA Airman Certification Branch. Otherwise, you may not exercise your privileges. Make that notification online by going to FAA.gov. You are directly responsible for, and you are the final authority for, the safe operation of the aircraft. Should an emergency require immediate action, you may deviate from Part 91 to the extent necessary in the interest of safety. If you exercise your emergency authority and deviate from the rules, you must provide a written report to the FAA if requested. If you receive a clearance that would cause you to deviate from a rule, you should query the controller and request that the clearance be amended. So this puts the onus of clearance adherence on your shoulders. Before beginning a flight, you are required to become familiar with all available information concerning that flight. That includes runway lengths, takeoff and landing information for the airports of intended use, and aircraft performance data. Now, if your flight is not in the vicinity of an airport, you also have to consider weather reports and forecasts, fuel requirements, and alternative courses of action if the flight cannot be completed as planned. The fuel requirements for day VFR is enough fuel to fly to the first point of intended landing at normal cruising speed, and then to fly after that for at least 30 minutes during the day or 45 minutes at night. And if you're computing this 30 minutes, that's really not a lot of time. I would use the maximum fuel consumption figure so that you have a built-in buffer. All required flight crew members must remain in their seats with their seat belts secured during the entire flight. When the shoulder harness is installed, it must be used during takeoffs and landings. So the seat belt has to be on at all times, unless you have to get up, and your shoulder harness has to be on for takeoff and landing if the shoulder harness is installed. Prior to takeoff, you have to ensure that each person on board has been briefed on the use of seat belts, and you have to ensure that passengers are notified to fasten their seatbelts during taxi, takeoff, and landing. Any child who has not reached his or her second birthday may be held by an adult. Right-of-way rules. An aircraft in distress has the right-of-way over all other aircraft. When aircraft of the same category are converging at approximately the same altitude, except head-on or nearly so, the aircraft on the other's right has the right of way. A balloon has the right of way over any other category of aircraft. A glider has the right of way over an airship, airplane, or rotorcraft, and an airship has the right of way over an airplane or rotorcraft. An aircraft towing or refueling has the right of way over all other engine-driven aircraft. When aircraft are approaching each other head-on or nearly so, each pilot of each aircraft, regardless of category, shall alter course to the right. An aircraft being overtaken has the right of way. The overtaking aircraft shall alter course to the right to pass well clear. When two or more aircraft are approaching an airport for landing, the aircraft at the lower altitude has the right of way, but shall not take advantage of this rule to cut in front of or overtake another. If any passengers are carried, the pilot of an aircraft may not intentionally exceed 60 degrees of bank or 30 degrees of pitch unless each occupant is wearing an approved parachute. Now, this does not apply when a certified flight instructor is giving instruction in spins or any other flight maneuver required by regulations for a rating. If the parachute is a chair type, it must have been packed by a certificated and appropriately rated parachute rigger within the preceding 120 days. When you receive a clearance from ATC, you may not deviate from that clearance except in an emergency, or if you obtain an amended clearance. If you do deviate from a clearance or an instruction from ATC during an emergency, you must notify ATC of the deviation as soon as possible. If it's an emergency and you're given priority over other aircraft by ATC, ATC may request that you submit a detailed report even though no deviation occurred. The report shall be submitted within 48 hours to the chief of the ATC facility which granted the priority. There's no minimum safe altitude that applies during takeoff or landing. Except for the purpose of takeoff or landing, you must maintain an altitude which, in the event of an engine failure, will allow you to do an emergency landing without undue hazard to persons or property on the surface. Over congested areas, you have to maintain an altitude of at least 1,000 feet above the highest obstacle within 2,000 foot radius. That same 1,000 above 2,000 horizontal must be maintained over any congested area of a city, town, settlement, or over any open-air assembly of people. If you're flying in other than a congested area, you have to maintain an altitude of 500 feet above the surface, except over open water or sparsely populated areas. In that case, you may not operate closer than 500 feet to any person, vehicle, vessel, or structure. You must maintain certain cloud clearance requirements for operations in specific airspace areas. You just got to know what these are. You've got to memorize them. You've got to figure out a way of learning them. And the table is in part 91-155. Of course, this is a very important piece of information, so it's also found in lots of publications. I mean, it's found in the Pilot's Handbook of Aeronautical Knowledge. It's found in the It's also found on little placards around flight schools and around airports. And it's just stuff you have to know. So we're going to go over basic VFR weather minimums. Picture, if you would, a blackboard or a whiteboard. And we're going to draw a chart on this board. And the chart has two horizontal lines. It's a big box with two horizontal lines. There's a horizontal line two-thirds of the way across the top. And there's a horizontal line a third of the way. So there are three rows on this table. The top row pertains to operations above 10,000 feet. The middle row pertains to operations below 10,000 feet, but more than 1,200 feet above the surface. And the bottom row pertains to operations less than 1,200 feet above the surface. Now, this chart that I'm having you visualize is simplified. There are a couple of very minor changes, but you'll get the idea and you'll get the basics by visualizing and learning this chart. Now, this table with the three rows, the top row is above 10,000 feet, the middle row is above 1,200 but less than 10,000 and the bottom row is below 1,200, that's going to stay the same, that's not going to change. But we're going to split the table down the middle. And on the left side of the table, we're going to say that that is controlled airspace, such as Class Echo airspace or Class Delta airspace or Class Bravo airspace, controlled airspace. And then the right side, we're going to just generally call it uncontrolled airspace. So let's look at the left side of the table, controlled airspace. Above 10,000 feet, you're required to have 5 statute miles visibility, and your cloud clearance is 1,000 feet above, 1,000 below, and 1 statute mile. So in the first column of the first row, put a big number 5, and then above that 5, put 1,000, below that 5, put 1,000, and then put a 1 next to it, so it'll be 5-1, which means 5 miles visibility, 1,000 above, 1,000 below, 1 mile horizontal. That's your minimum cloud clearance and visibility requirement for operating above 10,000 feet in controlled airspace. And you know what it is in uncontrolled airspace? It's the same. It's 5 statute miles visibility, 1,000 above, 1,000 below, and 1 mile horizontal. See? Wasn't that easy? That's a third of the information, and it's 5 miles visibility, 1,000 above, 1,000 below, 1 statute mile horizontal. Now, we're in the second row. We are more than 1,200 feet above the surface, but less than 10,000 feet. In the left column, put a big number 3, which stands for 3 miles, and in the right column, put a 1, which stands for 1 mile. So the minimum cloud clearance requirement for controlled airspace at middle altitudes is 3 miles visibility. And the cloud clearance is going to be the same for the left and the right. It's 500 below, 1,000 above, and 2,000 horizontal. 500 feet below the clouds, 1,000 feet above the clouds, and 2,000 feet horizontal distance from the clouds. The reason it's lower below the clouds than above the clouds is because clouds tend to rise. They tend to build up, and it's based on the vertical development of clouds. Now the bottom row of the chart has 2 columns, a left and a right. The left is controlled, the right is uncontrolled, and the bottom row represents from the surface up to 1,200 feet. And it's the same as it is in controlled airspace above 1,200 feet. It's 3 miles visibility, 500 feet below, 1,000 feet above, and 2,000 foot horizontal. So the left, entire left column is either 5 miles visibility or 3 miles visibility. Below 1,200 feet, controlled airspace, 3 miles visibility, 1,000 above, 500 below, 2,000 horizontal. So the left column at the very bottom is 3 miles. 3 miles visibility is the same as the one above it. 3 miles visibility, and the cloud clearance is 500 below, 1,000 above, and 2,000 horizontal. So the entire left side, the first column, is done. 5 miles at the top and 3 miles in the middle, 3 miles at the bottom. The right side. The visibility is either going to be 1 or 3, depending on whether it's day or night. Now I told you we're going to keep this simple, right? So let's just keep this discussion to daytime operations, and we'll put in the exceptions after we learn the rules. So for daytime, it's going to be 1 mile visibility. And the cloud clearance for daytime is clear of clouds. So on the lower right cell of the table, you could put a big number 1 and the word clear next to it, which means 1 mile visibility, clear of clouds. What happens at night? At night, it goes to 3 miles visibility, 500 below, 1,000 above, and 2,000 horizontal. The bottom of the table has a 3 on the left side, has a 1 on the right, and then underneath the 1 you could put a 3, and then put those same cloud clearance requirements that are most popular on the table, 500 below, 1,000 above, and 2,000 horizontal, and that applies to nighttime. Now, there's a little exception to this rule. There's an exception by looking at 91.155b. What that allows you to do is it allows you to fly around an airport at night with less than 3 miles visibility if you're just staying in that airport. And the reason for that is a lot of airports are located where the controlled airspace begins at 700 feet above the airport. Now, the exception is 91.155b, and it pertains to operations in Class G airspace below 1,200 feet above the surface. Because the idea is if you want to practice touch-and-go landings at an airport, you're not going to go above 1,200 feet. You'll be probably 1,000 feet above the ground. And you don't need 3 miles visibility to fly around this little airport and practice your touch-and-goes at night. So 91.155b gives you the permission to fly when the visibility is less than 3 miles. You need at least one statute mile. The airplane has to be operated clear of clouds, and if operated in an airport traffic pattern, within 1/2 mile of the runway. Now, when we made this table, I said we're making a column for controlled and uncontrolled. The uncontrolled airspace is, it's Class Gulf airspace. So the right side of the table is Class Gulf airspace, and the left side of the table is going to be Class C, Class D, or Class E airspace. It was just easier to write the table controlled and uncontrolled, because that way you have an idea of how this works. The reason this exists is to keep the traffic operating under instrument flight rules insulated from traffic operating under visual flight rules. The idea of not flying above 1,200 feet is that a lot of the instrument approach minimums, the higher minimums anyway, take you down to around 1,200 feet above the ground. If you, as a private pilot, don't have at least 3 miles visibility, you shouldn't be up there, because there's traffic shooting an instrument approach. They need to be able to get in with visibilities of 1 to 3 miles. Whereas you need basically 3 miles visibility to operate under basic VFR. That's the rule of thumb. You know, VFR is basically 3 miles visibility. If it's less than 3 miles visibility, it's considered marginal VFR. Actually, 1 mile to 3 miles is considered marginal VFR. 3 to 5 is considered VFR. Categorically, VFR weather is visibilities 3 miles or better. Categorically, marginal VFR is visibilities 1 to 3 miles. And categorically, IFR weather is visibility less than 1 mile. The other exception to this is special VFR. You can receive a clearance as a private pilot. You can receive a clearance to operate under special VFR when the ceiling is less than 1,000 feet and or the visibility is less than 3 miles within Class Bravo, Charlie, Delta, or Echo airspace for airports. Your requests for special VFR should be made with a control tower, and in order to receive a special VFR clearance and comply with it, you're required to have a flight visibility of at least 1 mile, and you must remain clear of the clouds. You can operate under special VFR, but only during daylight hours. Any request for special VFR at night, you have to have an instrument rating and your aircraft has to be instrument equipped. At airports where special VFR will not be given, or the letters SVFR are printed on the chart, and those are the busy metropolitan areas like Dallas-Fort Worth, Dallas-Love, big airports. It's indicated on the chart. When you're operating an aircraft under VFR in level cruising flight more than 3,000 feet above the surface, you're required to maintain an appropriate altitude in accordance with certain rules. This is called the VFR cruising altitude rule, and the requirement is based on your magnetic course, not your magnetic heading. So the way you remember which altitude to fly at is that if you're flying eastbound, it's an odd altitude plus 500. So when you're more than 3,000 feet above the ground and you're in level flight cruising eastbound, you need to be flying at an odd altitude plus 500, like 5,500, 7,500, 9,500, 11,500. If you're flying westbound, it's an even altitude plus 500, such as 6,500, 10,500, 12,500. And this is based on magnetic course, not magnetic heading. The east and westbound magnetic courses are determined by 0 to 179 degrees is east, and 180 degrees to 359 degrees is west. If you intend to fly formation flying, prior arrangements with the pilot in command of each aircraft is required. In any case, if you're going to fly formation, you may not carry passengers for hire in formation flight. Regarding dropping of objects, you are allowed to drop objects from an airplane provided that reasonable precautions are taken to avoid injury or damage to persons or property on the ground. The PIC may not allow any object to be dropped in flight unless reasonable precautions are taken to avoid injury or damage to persons or property on the ground. A flight plan form is found in Figure 52. Flight plans are not mandatory, but they're considered good operating practice. The purpose of the flight plan is to provide a track of where you are for search and rescue purposes. It's recommended that a separate flight plan be filed for each leg when the stop is expected to be more than 1 hour. You are required to close your flight plan upon the completion of your flight. You do this by contacting the nearest flight service station. The way you find out which flight service station to call is on the sectional chart. There are frequencies published for flight service stations that are in the area. There are also frequencies in the airport facilities directory for that airport. Also, when you get your pre-flight weather briefing, you can also get the information about who to close the flight plan with by asking for that information from the flight service station briefer when you are getting your pre-flight weather briefing. What you need to know on the written test about a flight plan is that in Block 7 of the flight plan, cruising altitude, enter the initial cruising altitude, even if more than one cruising altitude is intended. In Block 9, which is the destination airport, file only to the point of first intended landing, and then refile for each leg to your final destination. In Block 9, enter the name or the coded identifier of the destination airport. In Block 12, you enter the amount of usable fuel expressed in hours and minutes. The term category, when used with respect to certification of aircraft, mean a grouping of aircraft based on the intended use or their operating limitations, such as normal category, utility category, acrobatic category, restricted category, or experimental category. Both the restricted and the experimental category are aircraft in which you're prohibited from carrying persons or property for compensation or hire. Also, both categories are normally prohibited from flying over densely populated areas or in congested airways. Speed limits are 250 knots below 10,000 MSL. The speed limit within Class Bravo airspace is 250 knots. Some Class Bravo airspace have VFR corridors, and if you're flying inside of a VFR corridor, the speed is 200 knots. If you're in Class Delta airspace, you're restricted to a maximum of 200 knots indicated airspeed. All these airspeeds are indicated airspeed. So 250 knots below 10,000, 250 knots within Class Bravo, 200 knots through a Class Bravo corridor or in the airspace underlying Class Bravo airspace, and 200 knots in Class Delta airspace. NTSB Part 830 contains rules pertaining to the notification and reporting of aircraft accidents and incidents. It also contains rules for the preservation of aircraft wreckage, mail, cargo, and records. The term accident means an occurrence in which any person suffers death or serious injury, or in which the aircraft receives substantial damage. The term incident means an occurrence other than an accident which affects or could affect the safety of operations. You're required to notify the NTSB immediately when an aircraft accident occurs and any of a specified list of incidents. Immediate notification is required for the inability of a flight crew member to perform his or her duties due to illness or injury. Immediate notification is required for an in-flight fire. Immediate notification is required for flight control system malfunction or failure. And immediate notification is required when an aircraft is overdue and believed to have been involved in an accident. The operator of the aircraft involved in the accident or incident is responsible for preserving the wreckage, mail, or cargo until the NTSB takes custody. These items may be moved to protect the wreckage from further damage. The only time you can move the items is to protect them from further damage. The operator of an aircraft involved in an accident is required to file an accident report within 10 days. A report of an incident must be made only upon request.